Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Diabetology for the Medical Oncologist. I'm so excited to have this webinar today. We're going to talk about managing hyperglycemia in patients with breast cancer receiving agents targeting PIK3 AKT-P10 pathway. We have a great faculty today, Ms. Jamie Carroll, a nurse practitioner from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, Professor Giuseppe Sirigliano, from the University of Milano, European Institute of Oncology in Milano, Italy, and Dr. Marie McDonald. Very excited to have her here. She's the director of the diabetes program at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and Dr. Hope Rugo from the City of Hope Comprehensive Cancer Center in Duarte, California. So we're going to talk about hyperglycemia and diabetology today. As is often in the case, we may be discussing the use of agents and regimens that are not approved. So check out the prescribing information and I will say there's a lot of great information on this topic and the prescribing information as well. Here's where we're heading. We're going to start out talking a little bit of an introduction and talk about on-body glucose monitoring. Then Marie's going to give a talk providing kind of an overview of this and talk a little bit about biology. Our faculty presents some cases, then we'll take a look at the data from the trials and really try to focus in prevention and management of this very important problem. Before we get into the on-body glucose system, I just want to kind of put out a general thought, and I'm going to start with you, Hope. We were chatting a little bit about this before we get started. In terms of dealing with hyperglycemia in an oncology practice, I'm curious how comfortable you think most oncologists are, Hope, dealing with this, and how easy or difficult it is to get to an endocrinologist, and whether or not primary care docs are ever useful in this situation. Any thoughts, Hope?
Yeah, it's a complicated time. It used to be our primary care docs were treating patients primarily for diabetes, but I think it's kind of funny, as we have more drugs, it's become complicated. And so many primary care doctors really do rely on endocrinologists for consulting for changing treatment. And, if you have a simple, type 2 diabetes, well-controlled, no problem, the primary care doctor is doing that. In oncology, we're really dealing with patients who are much more complex, where a drug is actually, causing more hyperglycemia, and it can be much more difficult to know how to control it. So I think that what happens is, one, your first question, oncologists really don't like to manage the hyperglycemia associated with our drugs. We can do the first step and give metformin, but past that, we worry about the drugs and the dosages and how to give them and drug-drug interactions and all sorts of things. Off-target toxicities. And then the primary care doctors can sometimes be a first step, but really I've found that the best option is to interact with an endocrinologist with some interest in this area, where we both take a role in the patient care, understanding that the endocrinologist is not going to see the patient as often as an oncologist.
So I think that's great input. I also think it's great for oncologists to try to get as up-to-date as possible. And then one of the things I wanted to get into to start with, and I am curious, we actually asked this in the quiz. I'm curious what people are saying. I'm going to maybe see if we can get some early results from that before we get started here about how comfortable people are with the issue of on-body glucose monitoring, Marie. Of course, these are very, easy things to apply. They're widely available. I think even as possible, maybe you can comment on this to get some free samples of this for a couple months as people get started. But I don't know if everybody really realizes the granularity of what these devices provide. You can see here, not only do you see the patient's glucose level, but you see what it's been doing over the past 24 hours. And it's a much more granular understanding. And also this glucose management indicator, which is sort of comparable to the hemoglobin A1C, and then also another measurement, and you can access it yourself. You can electronically check your own patient's device and see what it's showing. Time in range. So how much time in the last 24 hours was the patient basically less than 180? Marie, any comments on sort of the granularity that the picture that you get from these devices compared to just doing fasting blood glucoses?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the biggest thing that we think of is that it's easier for patients and it doesn't cause pain to use these devices. So that we think of the cancer patient as a perfect patient for this type of monitoring. We have done studies showing patients like it. Even when they have cancer, they like having a little control over something, and I think glucose can be part of that. So the granularity, I think the main thing is for that you can see if people are having a lot of hyperglycemia, that percent time above range is important, and also time below. If they're having significant time below 70, you want to know that too, and then reach out to whoever's managing. At that point, it would be insulin probably if they're having hypoglycemia. But that GMI is useful. You know, it can be better and more accurate than the A1C in folks with anemia. So we're very much pro using continuous glucose monitoring, and it's just about accessing it. We can't rely on endocrinologists to do it only, because only about 25% of communities or counties in the U.S. have an endocrinologist. So that's the challenge, I think.
So I'm curious, Giuseppe, again, how you approach this, whether you are trying to manage this or referring to your endocrinologist. I'll tell you that the initial results we're getting back from the survey of our, and of course our attendees may be a little more up to speed than the average oncologist, but I'm kind of surprised because like about half of the attendees here feel pretty comfortable in understanding, for example, the on-body device as well as the two measurements that I just mentioned, and of course half do not. Giuseppe, how do you think this through? Or you use a lot of on-body devices in your patients?
We use for sure for patients that are diabetes because it's the best way to monitor glucose real time in order to correct treatment. Sometimes I prescribe this device in patients after discussion with the diabetologist where there is a risk to develop hyperglycemia. But of course, for fit patients that are not overweight with no baseline assessment at risk of diabetes, usually we don't use on-body glucose monitoring device.
So Jamie, I'm curious, at Mayo Clinic, how does this manage? And what about the APPs and your colleagues in terms of their interest and capability to deal with this issue?
I think we've learned a lot over the last 6 years since these agents have been approved. When we first started, we didn't know a lot about hyperglycemia and how that impacted. But now we have a lot more data and a lot more information. I think the APPs can be extremely helpful in educating patients, along with utilizing clinical pharmacists to talk with our patients and ensuring that we have that communication back and forth with the patients, because it's really important that if they're checking their glucose, that we understand what those values are and they don't end up with a value of 700 and nobody's aware.
So before you get into your talk, Marie, just kind of curious, something kind of flash in my head. When you put a flashlight on these patients and really start looking at their glucoses, I'm curious what you see in terms of corticosteroids. Do you see people getting glucose bumps? Is it more in diabetics when they get preemptive steroids? Any comments on how that sort of may complicate the matter?
Yeah, sure. I would say steroid-induced hyperglycemia is the bread and butter, if you will, of cancer-related hyperglycemia still, I think. And people with prediabetes, their A1Cs between 5.7 and 6.4 are the ones that I think are missed a lot. We sort of assume they'll be all okay. But most of them develop hyperglycemia on high-dose dexamethasone. So it would be great to identify those folks ahead of time just to warn them. But diet is great. You know, we could talk maybe a little bit about that later, but low-carbohydrate diet with the steroids is very helpful, probably with all of these forms of hyperglycemia.
I completely agree with Mary, because I remember when we did some trials combining paclitaxel together with PI3 kinase inhibitors, the use of steroids dramatically increased the rate of hyperglycemia. So steroids contribute to this risk, specifically in patients overweight or with a baseline assessment that is borderline.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
All right. Well, Marie, you prepared a few slides here just to sort of get us warmed up. And just a reminder to the audience, we're going an hour and a quarter here today. We tacked on an extra 15 minutes because there's so much to talk about here today. So, Marie, let's get started with sort of an overview.
All right, great. And I'll breeze through a little bit. I think our goal is just to set the stage really for the discussion. But this is what we'll talk about in the course of our time together. I just want to introduce I'm at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and we see a lot of complex diabetes. And right now, we're still partnering very closely with Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. We also have the MGB Cancer Center. But I would say my APPs and my endocrinology team members, they will say that some of the most complex patients that we see are coming from the oncology group. And it's because of different agents, but also the patients. They need special care, and we try to deliver that. One thing that is really important in why we're doing this conference, for example, is that the prevalence of diabetes in the background population has increased. Just in our population in Boston, we just looked at two time frames, as you can see. But when we added just 3 years beyond 2017, the number of people with diabetes tripled, or doubled, I should say. And the number of people who had poorly controlled diabetes also doubled just by in that three-year time period. So we're seeing I hate to use the word onslaught, but it feels like a lot of patients, and we just think a lot about how to take care of them correctly. The other thing, and we've already heard about this, is that the reason for the rise in diabetes in cancer is not just because of cancer drugs, but it's also because obesity and diabetes prevalence is rising. And we also know that it's difficult to connect patients to care at the right time. And patients might slip, you know, they might have prediabetes and not be diagnosed prior to cancer, and therefore it becomes much more of a surprise when they develop hyperglycemia. So one of the reasons we're seeing dramatic increases in diabetes in cancer is related to the background prevalence and how we're managing patients. I like to use the breast cancer case because we see a lot of, and Dr. Rugo knows more about this than I do, but we see a lot of, there's a lot of literature linking diabetes and breast cancer as an adenocarcinoma, similar, I guess, to colon cancer. But it's pretty dramatic. So more than 20% of women with breast cancer in the U.S. have diabetes. That's somewhat outdated, but it's probably even more dramatic now. The prevalence in the general adult population is about 10 or 11%. So it's about double. And type 2 diabetes is undiagnosed in about a third. So it's a surprise to a lot of women with breast cancer. We do know that people with type 2 diabetes are more likely to not survive their cancer. But it turns out that's probably relevant mostly for earlier stage breast cancer survivors. Our team has shown that hyperglycemia may not be so impactful on metastatic disease survival, but certainly it's a disadvantage in general. And we're sensitive to that. The other issue with diabetes and cancer is that, as you know well, that it can lead to disruption in chemotherapy, and that's linked to poor outcomes. And I think my oncology colleagues have taught me that's one of the main reasons the outcomes might be less optimal in diabetes patients, because they miss treatment. The other thing, and this is a little bit assumed on our part, that patients are harder to engage in their diabetes. I think the truth is a lot of patients feel like they can control diabetes when the cancer feels a little bit out of their hands. So in my hands, I feel like when they engage with me that I can offer something in terms of them feeling like they can do something about it. There are no evidence-based models really of care. There are groups that have tried to do this. This is a group I've worked with, including folks from UCSF. And University of Nebraska, and trying to design and develop ways that we could potentially collaborate with oncology teams in caring for patients with diabetes. Lots of folks have developed algorithms. There's actually a newer paper, this is in 2024, that worked with oncology groups to develop a consensus model for what would be acceptable for oncology and endocrinology to treat patients. And I think what we learned from that is, like Dr. Hope had said to us prior, Dr. Rugo, that metformin is a very comfortable place for oncologists. But beyond metformin, it becomes tricky.
So before we go on, just a pause for a second to get some thoughts from the other faculty And I'm curious, you know, it's interesting that thought about, well, oncologists are okay using metformin, but when they get beyond that hope, they want to at least talk to an endocrinologist. I'm curious about GLP-1 drugs, though, Hope. Do you find yourself using those or prescribing them, or you also, you know, deal with endocrinologists?
You know, it's so funny. I was just thinking about this, that, you know, patients will come in and say, can I microdose? You know, I want to lose weight. Can I microdose? And it's becoming more and more of an issue. And, you know, people will buy these drugs out of pocket. You know, they can get cheap drugs and they can get the compounded drugs. So, you know, in that situation, I'm not prescribing, but I'm okaying the use of those drugs. I'm not as familiar with giving the drugs for hyperglycemia. So I like to not, I think we've always thought, wow, there's so many drugs. I need to like have the jingle of the television ad to know which one to prescribe. And there are some drug-drug interactions. There's some decisions about, you know, what would be better if somebody has mild renal insufficiency, if they're elderly, et cetera. So I like to talk to an endocrinologist. Sometimes our timing is not good with when we can get the patient in. So, you know, we talk to an endocrinologist, say, what would you do in this situation? We can always start a drug while we're waiting for a visit to happen, and even have a follow-up. And to me, that's sort of the best way of dealing with a situation where we often can't get a patient in soon enough to be managed. And I'm kind of interested in, you know, Marie's and Jamie's experiences with that situation as well, because, you know, it can be a complicated situation. I had one patient where I just couldn't, you know, I had to really work on getting that patient in. We put a lot of work into it. Then, you know, in the end, we could manage it. And there's like really three classes of drugs we give patients. So the GLP-1 agonists being the ones I think that we are the most familiar with after metformin.
So, yeah, I was curious, Marie, in terms of agree or disagree, GLP-1 drugs can, in some patients, have very significant effect on glucose metabolism and diabetes. Do you agree with that? And what is a clinical situation where you can see a pretty significant effect of GLP-1 drugs?
Yes, I totally agree with it. And there's some theoretical concern about GLP-1s increasing insulin levels, but they don't really overall. They actually bring insulin levels down by reducing insulin resistance. So we see great effects with GLP-1s and steroid-induced hyperglycemia. Hmm. And they do help those who are taking the PI3 kinase pathway medications. The only challenge there is the GI side effects, because you do have to be aware of the patient. Are they maintaining adequate nutrition? The GLP-1s, you know, invariably cause decreased appetite, but they also can cause nausea and vomiting. So what I like to do, I like that Dr. Rugo said microdose in a sense, because we do try to microdose in patients who are undergoing chemotherapy so that we can minimize. But I know what she's referring to, folks trying to treat their weight with small doses that they can afford. But actually, low dose GLP-1 therapy can be very helpful in patients with cancer.
So, Jamie, any thoughts about that? And again, I bring up GLP because so many people are using it, as you mentioned. You know, it's so easy to access, other than you mentioned the GI issues, but, you know, relatively safe too. Certainly not as, you know, for oncologists, getting beyond insulin, even insulin itself can be challenging. And I'm very interested about what you were saying in terms of steroid-induced hyperglycemia. Anyhow, Jamie, any observations in terms of GLP-1 drugs in your clinic?
Yeah, I think a lot of patients are using GLP-1s, and that number is increasing over time. So they're definitely here to stay. I think we just have to know how our drugs are impacting patients' blood glucose and then utilizing our endocrinology folks for help when we have cancer-directed medications, GLP-1, and when do you utilize an additional medication if they're already taking something like metformin or already on a GLP-1.
So, yeah, I bring that up because I think when you hear GLP-1, the first thing you think about is losing weight, but it actually also can be effective in managing hyperglycemia. All right, well, let's get more into the pharmacology and biology of this situation and how these agents that we're going to talk about today actually affect the glucose metabolism, Marie.
All right, sure thing. So this is the classic pathway that endocrinologists all learn when we're in sort of training and fellowship. And the idea here is that insulin is a growth factor. So insulin and also insulin-like growth factor binds this little receptor in the surface of many, many cells in the body. And it triggers a cascade of enzymatic reactions. So it binds this receptor. The receptor recruits P85 and PI3 kinase, PI3 kinase first, and then recruits these other enzymes into a complex. Then you'll see a cascade that ends up at AKT, which is an important molecule that triggers, it's a very important for glucose metabolism and uptake of glucose into the cell. But you can also see there's another pathway that is through mTOR, which drives growth and proliferation and survival of the cell. So it makes a lot of sense that cancer therapies would try to block or reduce any mechanism that a cell might adopt to improve growth and survival. And it turns out that in cancer cells, there's a common mutation that is the PIK3 kinase alpha isoform that can be mutated to be driven, to be increased, driven to have increased activity. In the beginning, when these drugs were being developed, the idea was to block this whole pathway. But if you do that non-specifically, it can actually backfire and increase the whole pathway. So the companies realize that if they block the PA3 kinase, just the alpha isoform, along with potentially more downstream effects, it could be useful. The other thing that we learned is if you just go to the AKT or the mTOR by itself and just focus there, you have a limited impact and you might miss out on some effect on tumor growth by not impacting the glucose side. So the next slide, I think, sort of highlights the fact that when you activate AKT, you drive glucose into the cell so that that little GLUT4 molecule gets activated. So it turns out, from my understanding and what we've learned, is that if you can kind of block or slow down this whole process in tumor cells, you can really limit tumor growth and survival. The challenge, though, is that in the other cells, in healthy cells, we need this insulin signaling and we need glucose transport. And without it, you'll see hyperglycemia. This glucose is not going to get into the cell. So this is the story about the isoforms, which I sort of expressed, but I just want to highlight that the PI3 kinase alpha-specific drugs, they're specific to the uptake of glucose into skeletal and adipose tissues. They turned out to be the most effective PI3 kinase inhibitor drugs, but they also are the ones that cause the most hyperglycemia. So there's been more development in trying to balance this effect by maybe doing some downstream inhibition in addition to just the PI3 kinase inhibitor. So this is a little bit of a sketch to highlight some of the drugs that you are familiar with. So alpelisib is up at the top. This is a classical PI3 kinase alpha isoform inhibitor. So it blocks all of the downstream effects, including the mTOR as well as the metabolism piece. So you'll see some high blood glucose from alpelisib blocking that whole pathway. Inavolisib is also a PI3 kinase inhibitor. It's very potent, and it actually does a little bit downstream as well. The capivasertib is really interesting because it's AKT and mTOR specific, and it has less of an impact on glucose, probably because it has this balanced effect. And then the investigational GETA, I'm going to call it GETA because I won't pronounce it correctly. It's PI3 kinase, but a little bit more downstream. So it'll be interesting to see really what it's looking like. And we see some preliminary information on how it affects glucose. Okay, so maybe do we want to go here or we want to stop for a little bit?
Why don't we talk a little bit? We're actually going to get into some cases. But first, Giuseppe Conlin in the chat room brings up something I haven't thought about. I'm just kind of curious. Wants to know, any thoughts on hyperglycemia associated with ADCs with MMAE payloads? Is that an issue? I'm not sure I've heard of it.
Maybe the only scenario in which you can have a hyperglycemia using using an ADC was exactly in patients with brain mets because there is the concurrent administration of steroids. And so there is higher risk of hyperglycemia. This is the only scenario where you can have cases of hyperglycemia. That is an issue because if you have also neutropenia, there is a higher risk also of pneumonitis. And, you know, in this case, you cannot understand what is related to the use of steroids and what is related eventually to the drug. But this is the only scenario where you can see something like this.
Really interesting. Marie, it's interesting to think about this issue of CNS and the steroids these patients get. Do you recommend any preemptive strategy? You mentioned GLP-1. Anything you do preemptively, people are going to get high doses of steroids, as with brain mets.
Yes,
Go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, you know, the preemptive treatment is super important for steroid induced as well as the PI3 kinase pathway people, folks. You know, it's the same idea. Metformin and GLP-1 receptor agonist therapy are both useful for steroid-induced, but also probably for the PI3 kinase inhibition.
Interesting. All right, let's get into some cases and see how this sort of plays out in the clinic. Hope, you have a 79-year-old lady. What happened with her?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's such an interesting discussion about how we manage this. And I think the first thing we do, which is so important, is to screen for risk. So this is a 79-year-old woman who had a node-positive breast cancer, then developed metastatic disease. So frustrating, you know, after treating everybody correctly. And there she has metastatic disease, ER-positive, PR-negative. She gets letrozole and palbo for 2.5 years, then letrozole abemaciclib, and she was switched not because of progression, but because she had anemia. She then got that for 1.5 years. So now, you know, she's been on for 4 years. Then she has progressive disease in liver, but with very... you know, ER-positive liver, like a couple of liver lesions. Liver biopsies, ER-PR-positive. She has an ESR1 mutation and a PIK3CA mutation. So she then receives elacestrant and ribociclib on a clinical trial and responds really well for a year. So then she has slow progression in liver. And I have to say, we're dealing with this kind of question all the time about what to do with these patients. Like, should we give them the CDK4/6 inhibitor first if they have both mutations, or should we give them the drug that targets the PIK3CA pathway or PI3 kinase pathway? In any case, in this case, we went trial. So we went trial, then we went to fulvestrant and capivasertib. Her hemoglobin A1C was 5.4 when she started, and she had a normal fasting glucose. So she did fine. I'm checking her glucose all the time. Glucose is normal, you know, because at 79, I wanted to make sure she's okay. So then her family visits for the holidays. She has a low-grade fever and diarrhea. So she calls in on Sunday. She comes in Monday, her glucose is normal, like 84. Then 2 days later, she has a fever, her diarrhea worsens, she feels awful. We send her to the emergency room where her glucose was 461. I was completely blown away by this. She got a big workup, held her capivasertib, and she was hydrated, got insulin, everything normalized, her diarrhea went away, and she went on metformin 500 milligrams twice a day and then 1,500 because I find a lot of GI symptoms in our patients with metformin. So then on January 15th, so 2 weeks later, she restarted capi at a dose reduction and since then did totally fine and actually never had another episode of hyperglycemia. And not only that, she stayed on drug for a year, having just recently progressed and gone on to TDXD. So this just shows you the labs and how normal they were before she had this spike in her glucose. And you can see that single spike there that you really have to be aware. Somebody doesn't know. After this patient had her unexpected hyperglycemia, I tell everybody, you don't feel good, you have a fever, don't take your drug. And then call us so that they don't end up with this really worse situation. Because she called, we had her come in, we were okay. But imagine, you know, if you treat at home, maybe, you know, you're going to end up with a lot of problems with the hyperglycemia and even DKA. But she made it through and was able to stay on drug for a year without progression.
And just to clarify, I think you did not use preemptive metformin, but when you started the CAPI, right?
Well, because we don't do that for patients who are normal.
Exactly, because her glucose, et cetera.
We followed the label.
We'll talk about
her glucose was all normal.
Right. So we'll get more into the ins and outs of metformin. But Marie, I'm just kind of curious what you think about this case.
Yeah.
Particularly dramatic how she started out so well and then bumped so fast. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think probably the illness that she had was the concomitant, you know, whether it be viral syndrome or some, you know, she was immunocompromised a little bit. And that just drove everything up. I mean, it's really like being on steroids. I tell my patients when you're sick, it's just your own body's steroids are high. So it's equivalent of being on steroids and having the PI3 kinase inhibition. And it's just sort of a perfect storm. I see she's a volume deplete from probably the diarrhea related to the drug. I don't know if that was what you thought, Hope, but that's part of it. When you're volume deplete, you shut down and you can't actually excrete glucose. It makes your glucose much higher. So it was a perfect storm. So you treated her beautifully. I think in the end that was great.
That's good to hear about the volume. Fascinating. Her gram is normal, but maybe it does play a role.
Yeah, and the idea of endogenous steroids also is very intuitive and interesting to bring up as well. So, I mean, actually, I think these two cases with Cappy are kind of unusual, and you know, much more typically might have been seen with alpelisib, and we'll talk about that later. But Giuseppe, do you want to just sort of summarize what happened with your patient also on Cappy fulvestrant, who also had issues with hyperglycemia, I think 1/400.
Yes, this was a 61-year-old overweight woman with a family history of breast cancer. Unfortunately, she did a de novo metastatic disease diagnosis. So she received a first-line treatment with ribociclib and letrozole. And 1 year later, even if she was in complete response, and that's why we did bilateral nipple-sparing mastectomy, because there was a BRCA mutation. Unfortunately, she progressed again. Genetic testing with a liquid biopsy showed a PI3 kinase mutation, and so we started a treatment with capivasertib and fulvestrant. And since she was overweight, what we did was a baseline assessment with a fasting glucose that was 126, and hemoglobin A1C 5.2%. So finally, after this baseline assessment, we started with fulvestrant and capivasertib. We know perfectly that in patients overweight, there is a higher risk to develop a grade 3 or 4 hyperglycemia. And this is what exactly happened in this patient, because we know perfectly that after 10 to 15 days, you can have an increase of glycemia. And the fasting blood glucose in this patient was 450. So I stopped the treatment with capivasertib. I contacted my endocrinologist in the hospital because this was more than a grade 3 hyperglycemia. And finally, they started the treatment with metformin and, of course, in this case, also insulin. And once there was a complete control of the hyperglycemia, what we did, we restarted again capivasertib at a lower dose, and the patient is still on treatment, actually.
Interesting. Again, Marie, any comments, and also any comments on dose reduction and the impact that you see?
I guess it's a really good, both cases are an example of how you cannot necessarily predict when patients are going to have trouble. And obesity is an interesting problem because people can maintain normal glucose with severe insulin resistance for a long time, and you just need to be pushed over the edge, quote unquote, with a PI3 kinase inhibitor sometimes. And then it's, you know, you see that. We see that sometimes. The dose reduction strategy is commonly used, I see, and it works very well. We usually hold it, as I think happened here, and then restart at a lower dose, usually with another therapy on board. In this case, I probably would have used either an SGLT2 inhibitor, which is a drug that drives glucose into the urine, or a GLP-1 receptor agonist, if she was able to tolerate it. But I think it remains to be seen. You have to see what else is going on with the patient.
Just kind of curious, I'll ask Hope, any thoughts about why we saw such, you know, we'll get into this a little bit later, but we saw such serious problems, a lot more cases like this and even worse with alpelisib, and a lot less problems with the newer agents, inavolisib and capivasertib. Any thoughts, Hope?
You know, it's interesting. So alpelisib is alpha-specific also, but not very mutant specific. And I think as we've gotten to the next generation drugs, you know, an AKT inhibitor is going to have a little less effect on that pathway. And then inavolisib, I think, you know, we are more experienced and it just has less of that effect because of a differential impact on the pathway. But, you know, it's interesting with capivasertib, we don't see a lot of hyperglycemia. We can treat patients with high hemoglobin A1Cs, much easier to control. Again, my patient, it went up when she was sick, went down, didn't go back up again. But she, you know, we dose reduce. With inavolisib, the studies actually focused on patients who had low hemoglobin A1C. So it was had to be less than 6%. But because your fasting glucose had to be under 125, most of the people had normal hemoglobin A1Cs. So we are seeing hyperglycemia with inavolisib that's really requiring a lot of proactive management. I would say that, you know, in my experience, again, we're using it as a triplet because that's how it's approved. It will be interesting to see as we start giving it later in second line therapy in doublets, will we see more hyperglycemia? Because with alpelisib, we didn't know what we were doing, you know, so we didn't start out protecting people up front. And so I don't know. I mean, it doesn't cause the rash of alpelisib, so it's clearly a different agent. But I do think we have to, as we'll see in our cases, really think about what we're doing before we give the drug.
Yeah, because I was thinking that part of the reason is I don't think we were even thinking about it much, you know, a few years ago when alpelisib came out, and now it's much more in our consciousness. Before Jamie actually has it,
we were like stuck.
That's another
right?
thing.
If metformin right, didn't work exactly. and those other nasty drugs didn't work, you were on insulin. There was no other option.
Right,
so it was
right.
different.
Right.
We need also to right. highlight that the new generation of PI3 kinase inhibitor like zevagolisib that is recently FDA approved, it's a breakthrough designation. Finally, the risk of hyperglycemia is less than 15%. So the more these drugs are on target, less hyperglycemia you can observe. So there is really with the new generation PI3 kinase inhibitor less incidence of hyperglycemia. So it's more easy to manage the new generation drugs.
Yeah, that's a great point. Hope, did we see hyperglycemia with mTOR inhibitors?
We do see that. The only mTOR inhibitor, of course, approved for breast cancer is everolimus. And we do see it. We just see it a lot less. So, you know, again, when we started using everolimus, we're like, why is that patient short of breath? I mean, I was like, wow, there's actually pneumonitis from this drug. I mean, we learned a lot as we started giving the drugs to patients. And one of the things we learned about was hyperglycemia. So again, if I'm going to start somebody on everolimus, I'm going to try and control their hemoglobin A1C and glucose before I start to try and get them in better range, because otherwise you do run into hyperglycemia. And most of the studies do have some eligibility for that. So I found that the patients where I really had trouble with everolimus were insulin-dependent diabetes patients, and we don't; those patients have not been eligible for most of our trials. So, you know, we haven't seen them in that situation. Those people have really brittle diabetes; it's tough to manage.
That's interesting. All right. Well, here is a case from Jamie of a patient who got the inavolisib triplet, a 79-year woman. What happened with her, Jamie?
Yeah, so she first presented in 2020. She was diagnosed with an invasive ductal grade 3, was hormone positive, HER2 negative by FISH. She really wanted to avoid chemotherapy. So she had upfront bilateral mastectomy, and we said, well, you're T2 and 3A, probably should give you some chemo. So she got Adriamycin, Cytoxan, Taxol, followed by radiation and anastrozole. She continued on her anastrozole, tolerating it well, but presented in the fall of 2025 with acute shortness of breath to a local emergency department. Imaging showed she had a large pleural effusion. Cytology from the thoracentesis was positive for malignancy, consistent with her prior breast cancer. So we did next generation sequencing, and lo and behold, she had a PIK3CA mutation. So since she was on the anastrozole, it gave us the option to follow the ANAVO 120 and give her the triplet therapy. So we started her on palbociclib 125, inavolisib 9 milligrams, and then standard dose fulvestrant 500 milligrams. Within 2 weeks of starting, her fasting glucose jumped up to 199. So we said, well, you know, why don't you hold your inavolisib but continue to check your blood glucose, because we want to make sure that it starts trending towards normal as you're holding the inavolisib. So 1 week later, her blood glucose was 214. We said, that's odd. 2 days later, 229. 2 days later, 262. So we're like, what's going on here? Well, what happened was the patient held the wrong oral therapy.
Oh, no.
So she held her palbociclib instead of her inavolisib. And so we ended up saying, just hold everything, come into the clinic, let's chat. And so I think for this patient, being on two oral drugs that had two different treatment plans, you know, palbociclib you take 3 weeks on, 1 week off, and inavolisib you take daily, she just took the wrong drug and held the wrong one. And so I think, you know, it's really important that you have that close contact with the patient. Thankfully, we did close glucose monitoring and said, let's continue to watch you. And, you know, it kept going up because she was still on the offender.
So curious, Marie, any thoughts about this case? Also, again, this issue of hyperglycemia with inavolisib. Any thoughts?
Right. Well, this is a great case because the clue is in the time, right? Because it really does take just a few days to see the glucose come down. We in the hospital, we treat patients sometimes, and we see it within 24 hours just come down. But it usually takes a couple days to a week to see full resolution. So this is a pretty clear indicator. But I'm not surprised at the hyperglycemia. We see the same thing that I think the trials with inavolisib were. You saw less grade 3 hyperglycemia, maybe the same amount of general hyperglycemia as alpelisib. But in practice, it seems the same to us. So that probably just related to selecting the patient population for the trials, as Dr. Ruga mentioned. So this is a pretty, you know, and the other important point, the older adult is at baseline more likely to have hyperglycemia from these drugs, even if they have normal glycemia at baseline, just because of aging-related baseline hyperglycemia. So she's at risk for that reason, too.
What about the patient who already is on insulin, already having difficult control problems, Marie? How do you approach that patient who's about to begin one of these agents? And why is it that we're going to get into this, but I'm just going to bring it up now. Why is it that insulin is not really utilized in this situation?
Well, right. I mean, there's lots of data showing that endogenous hyperinsulinemia potentially drives cancer or tumorigenesis. So in most cancers, mostly adenocarcinomas, so the theory is that if endogenous insulin does that, then exogenous probably isn't the right treatment. However, you know, if you have PI3 kinase blockade, especially if it's more precise toward the mTOR pathway, and you have hyperglycemia, insulin should be okay. I mean, there's no choice, and it's driving glucose transport. So I don't really worry about the tumor side of it, and sort of going against the whole point of the PI3 kinase inhibitor. As long as that's on board, I think insulin therapy is fine. But and we have no choice, obviously. But we do try to make it last line. We do. We try to take it away. If we start it in the hospital, we try to wean it back off using other agents, and that can take weeks. So that's why starting insulin right away is often what happens, along with metformin. But we don't like it to be the end therapy in most of these patients.
So we're going to sort of dive into some of the data from the trials of these agents and also really get into management issues. I'll tell you that there's a ton of review articles on this topic. There's a lot of text in these articles. We like to talk about stuff more than write it in detail, and that's what we're doing here today. You can check out our slide set here. We have a whole bunch of great slides, but we're just going to really want to continue the discussion. I want to just start out and ask Cope to talk a little bit about the three major agents that we're going to talk about today, the key trials that led to their approvals, and particularly the eligibility criteria. Hope, can you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first agent we had that focused on PI3 kinase and had a positive trial result, of course, was alpelisib in SOLAR-1. And the, you know, it's interesting because there had been a number of agents that had been in phase two trials and even randomized phase two trials and had had negative results. And these were pan-PI3 kinase inhibitors. They had a lot of toxicity. One of them even caused severe depression, which was interesting, suicidal ideation. But alpelisib alpha-specific, so then it became clear that, you know, where we were going to really see the efficacy was going to be with alpha-specific inhibitors. And we did initially a study which showed that alpelisib had activity in these patients who had very endocrine-resistant disease. So if you think back into SOLAR-1, it showed a big improvement in progression-free survival. And although there was an eight-month improvement in overall survival, it was not statistically significant. The trend looked to be more in patients who had had visceral metastases. But this was before CDK4/6 inhibitors, before oral SERDs. I mean, just a lot of things that were then tested. So then we recently saw data from EPIC-B5, which actually looked at alpelisib in patients who had had CDK4/6 inhibitors. And what's fascinating was, you know, all of these results are relatively similar. It still showed a lot of benefit. Hyperglycemia, yes. Rash, two big things with alpelisib. But you did see a significant improvement in progression-free survival, even in patients who had a prior CDK4/6 inhibitor. So then we got capivasertib, and it's an AKT inhibitor, and highly specific for the most active subforms of AKT. And capivasertib also improved progression-free survival in where a lot of patients had prior CDK4/6 inhibitors. So the differences in hemoglobin A1C, so we started out with alpelisib. We allowed people to be up to 8%, but that created all sorts of problems. We saw a lot of hyperglycemia, so we reduced it to less than or equal to 6.4%. And that worked okay. But once people started using it in clinical practice, they really didn't know what to do. And again, this was before we had these, you know, fancy oral drugs that control glucose. And, you know, oncologists hate to give insulin. They just hate to give insulin. We don't know how to give it. We don't want to prescribe it. We don't like giving the regular, nothing. So that created a lot of problems, which we've now really come around about because we have these oral agents now, which really make the management of hyperglycemia completely different. Capivasertib allowed up to 7.9% hemoglobin A1C, and we see a lot less hyperglycemia. It's much easier to control. And again, this has to do with where you're impacting the pathway. And then inavolisib is also an alpha-specific PI3 kinase inhibitor. And here they didn't want to have the problems with alpelisib. So they limited patients to have a fasting glucose less than 126 and a hemoglobin A1C of less than 6%. But it actually turned out that your hemoglobin A1C was more likely to be 5.6 median if you're going to have a normal fasting glucose or close to normal, right? Because that if you're at 5.9%, your fasting glucose wasn't going to work unless you fasted a really long time. So then inavolisib, of course, is still, we're waiting for data in the second line setting, but it was a herald trial because it was based on animal data, murine data, that showed that a triplet of giving a CDK4/6 inhibitor, palbociclib and fulvestrant in patients with PI3 kinase activating mutations who relapsed early on their CDK4/6 on their adjuvant endocrine therapy with an AI would have not only an improved progression-free but also overall survival in INAVO120. Really remarkable data that came from these murine models. So of course now everybody's being tested with these triplet drugs in people who don't have upfront resistance. CAPI's being tested in the resistant population, and then we have some new designer mutant-specific alpha PI3 kinase inhibitors that are being tested, one in particular in that first-line setting as well in a triplet.
So in a second, I want Marie to comment on what she would do with a patient whose baseline hemoglobin A1C is over 8. But first, I'm going to get back to just Seppi because, you know, we see so many new trials nowadays, it's hard to keep everything, you know, in our focus. But when you go back and look at these trials, even without alpelisib, to me, the hazard rates are pretty impressive, at least in the trials. And I'm curious whether you see that in your practice, Giuseppe, in terms of efficacy of these agents. How effective do you find them? Again, the hazard rates in the trials are really pretty interesting, and Hope just mentioned the survival benefit as well with inavolisib.
Yes, I completely agree. Inavolisib improve overall survival and improve dramatically also median progression-free survival. So in my opinion, in the future, we will have much more PI3 kinase inhibitors in the first-line setting in combination with the CDK4/6 inhibitors for those patients that are endocrine resistant. So if this will be a new first-line therapy, it's important to better understand how to manage hyperglycemia. Because since you have an overall survival benefit and a dramatic median PFS benefit, adherence to treatment, reducing dose discontinuation, and managing the side effects will be crucial in order also to achieve these results. If we go in the second line, I have to be honest, the median PFS usually is around 7 months. Because the SOLAR-1 was a study in the pre-CDK4/6 inhibitor era, and then Dr. Rugo did this beautiful pragmatic trial that was the BYLieve in the post-CDK4/6 inhibitor setting, and in the BYLieve, median PFS is 7 months. Similar results with capivasertib, 7 months. So, but in the first-line setting with the INAVO study, and now we will have another study for endocrine-sensitive disease, it's really important to collaborate with endocrinologists in order to increase adherence to treatment.
So, Marie, any comments on the grading system? I know each trial uses a slightly different grading system, but sort of globally, how you grade hyperglycemia. And again, any thoughts? You know, patients don't, you know, docs don't want to wait to start treatment if they can avoid it. What you would do with somebody who's, again, hemoglobin A1C is high.
Right. Well, there's a couple points I wanted to make, which is because this is really about empowering the oncologists as well. You know, metformin extended release formulation is more tolerated. So making sure there's maximum metformin on board before starting these drugs, I think, is really useful. It's not always as effective as we want it to be, but it's important as background. And also diet. I talk to the oncology nurses all the time because they can do that. They can teach food. And if you eat a very high protein, low carb diet on these drugs, you do a lot better. Because one thing that we haven't talked about is that cycle of the diarrhea from the drugs, which I think is common also, and then the dehydration that ensues, and then you have, and that actually exacerbates hyperglycemia, and it's a vicious circle. So if we could teach people to hydrate and eat low carbs, it's useful, probably more useful than insulin in some cases. It's just that by the time somebody gets in trouble, like the cases we heard, you get stuck and you need insulin. But what would I do for a patient of mine, which is, you know, I had patients recently, their A1C is over 8. And that's not an uncommon scenario in breast cancer, for example, needing to start alpelisib, for example. What we do is we start, we try to buy some time by maximizing potent therapy. In her case, I started a GLP-1 receptor agonist. It's a very potent drug, but you need at least a week to get people sort of engaged with it. And we also, she was on metformin, and we were just prepared to start a third agent, which was either going to be insulin or another oral, depending on how high she got on alpelisib, because we knew she was going to have trouble.
So, Hope Shlomit in the chat room says they've been escalating INAVO slowly. They start out at 3 milligrams, and they check the glucose, and then go to 6, and then 9 if the glucose is okay. Any thoughts about that, Hope?
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny because I was just talking to somebody about a case of a patient who was on 2 drugs for hyperglycemia, and then one of the newer drugs, and then metformin, and still had a hemoglobin A1C, I think, of 8.2 or something. And we were talking about the fact that we would feel nervous about starting with a triplet. Then we would start with fulvestrant, palbo, work with armory, and try and manage the hemoglobin A1C and glucose. and then maybe start first at 3 milligrams. This is a patient who has a lot of comorbidities, and you want to try and give her the option with this early recurrence, but you also want to wait until you feel more secure. So you might start at 3 and go up to 6 and 9 every 2 weeks or something. I have found that the patients who really are already on agents for hyperglycemia, that they really can't tolerate full dose. So, mm-hmm. you know, in that situation, say somebody came in on 2 drugs and was well controlled, I'd probably start at 6. And so I think that that's, you know, I think it's reasonable in the patient who has existing hyperglycemia. For a patient who's in good shape, you know, I find that we can generally control things pretty well, and we don't have to start low in those patients. But it's what you feel comfortable with. You know, you just have to not, like, take months to go back up. I'll see these people who are still on, you know, 50 BID of abemaciclib 3 months into their treatment on a dose escalation. That's not dose escalation, so...
And I think we are seeing more studies actually looking at these agents in patients with diabetes prospectively to see how they do. I'm not going to talk too much about alpelisib other than ask Jamie. You know, not everybody's actually even used this drug or had that experience. I can remember when it first came out, and I was hearing a lot of cases being presented to me where people are saying, I'll never use this again. And as Hope was saying, it's not just about the hyperglycemia, et cetera. But any reflections back on the alpelisib days, Jamie?
I mean, I think that I'm glad that we have other agents that we can use. And I think we've kind of maybe used more capivasertib since that has been FDA approved. You know, we've learned a lot. The stomatitis was a lot with alpelisib, and so we used a lot of dex mouth rinse. But I think our patients are doing much better with other agents as well.
So again, we put a bunch of slides in there for you to check out and try to summarize some of the key points for, in terms of hyperglycemia with the newer agents, Inavo and capivasertib, Giuseppe. But maybe you could just sort of summarize globally about what we've seen in terms of when you see the onset of hyperglycemia and how often you see this to be a significant problem with both of these agents, Inavo and Capi.
Yes, with inavolisib, usually the overall incidence of hyperglycemia any grade is around 65% of the patient. It's important to remember that the median range of onset of hyperglycemia is around 7 days, between 7 and 10 days. And it's really important to remember that you need to manage it. So, first, encourage the patients to adopt a diabetic diet or hypocaloric diet. Consider every time a consultation with an endocrinologist or a diabetologist. If you work in a multidisciplinary team, you have a better way to address the problem, and of course, you can increase compliance to treatment. When we move to capivasertib, it's a little bit different because it's not an alpha selective, it's an AKT inhibitor finally, but the overall incidence of hyperglycemia usually is around, again, 60%. The median time of onset usually is 15 days with capivasertib. Again, very important also in this case, multidisciplinary management, in order to increase their compliance to treatment.
So Hope, any comments in terms of what we saw in the trials of capivasertib in terms of hyperglycemia? And also, I guess there was a sort of an update to the package insert specifically about hyperglycemia. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. In the clinical trial, you know, we always see that patients on clinical trials just do better and have less toxicity once we get them into practice. It's different. That was the issue with alpelisib, really, and everolimus before about mouth sores. People just, you know, didn't know how to manage them when it got into practice. And the same is true of Capi. So, you know, when people started, first of all, in the trial, as you showed on, I think, the previous slide, we just didn't see a lot of hyperglycemia. And it was kind of funny, like we had one patient got really hyperglycemic, and it turned out she had not taken her 3 days off. She'd just been taking the drug continuously for 2 weeks, similar to Jamie's patient before. And, you know, now we have a blister pack. People can take it correctly. We instruct them. But then why did, that was all, we knew that when the drug was approved. But this new labeling update came about because once the drug was in practice, in post-marketing, for both Capi and Inavo, there were cases of, you know, severe hyperglycemia, a few handful, small numbers, and for inavolisib as well, and, you know, a case of DKA even, which we were surprised about. And so we went back and looked at these patients in detail, and it turned out that at least one or two of them had a normal hemoglobin A1C, like my patient. And so I think that the label is really meant to really follow these patients more closely. Mm-hmm. My patient would not have been picked up by the change in label. So I think that what you want to do is not only monitor early to make sure they're not one of these people who gets that big jump in glucose right away, but also to educate the patient to hold drug if they don't feel good and to come in for labs. And with those two things, I really haven't had any problem at all with these patients. Again, I'm not putting patients on who have insulin-dependent diabetes. We don't see them a lot I have no idea why that is, but we don't see a lot of insulin-dependent diabetes. And maybe they do in other parts of the United States. And I think that those patients have much more difficult glucose to control. One thing I will say is that if you have a continuous glucose monitor and you have well-controlled glucose, you know, insulin dependent, you probably can give these drugs in a different way from before, when people had to, like, you know, they just didn't know what was going on with their glucose.
Yeah, I wonder if there's less insulin dependent. Maybe Marie can comment on it, because the more use of GLP-1 drugs.
Yeah, I think that's right. Also
related to this label update, one of the issues that sort of came up here is in terms of sort of geography. I think a lot of the patients in the trial were from Asia and outside the U.S., and it looked like when they started to look at it in the U.S., they saw more. What do you see in terms of geography and different races and culture in terms of hyperglycemia, Marie? The people at MD Anderson talk a lot about the Hispanic patients there having a high level of hyperglycemia. What do we see in general in terms of geography?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I would say in the U.S., we know ethnic groups are more at high risk, so certain ethnic groups, so Hispanic or Latino ethnic groups and Black ethnic groups, and Asian populations, specifically Koreans, do have an increased risk of diabetes per BMI, so they at a lower BMI, and this is very, very true also for South Asians. So there are groups who are at higher risk. They look like they might not be at risk. They might have a normal BMI, but we know that we need to consider a BMI of 23 as actually overweight in South Asians and in Chinese and in Koreans. So we mischaracterize patients, from different ethnic groups, something that the Lancet Commission and people around the world are trying to solve that problem. So I agree with you. I think different populations around the world would have different rates of insulin resistance at baseline. That makes a lot of sense.
So we already talked a bit about prevention and management, but I want to get more into this. I want to share an experience we had with that I thought you'd find interesting last Friday in San Francisco at the ASCO GU meeting. I thought you might find this interesting because, guess what? There was a positive phase 3 trial of capivasertib presented at ESMO in prostate cancer, hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. And so we actually did a program at the GU symposium where we talked about it. What I want to just point out to you, just for your interest, is this is a case that Dr. McKay presented by video. She and I did a video of a patient with metastatic prostate cancer, widespread disease. They have P10 deficient. That's what their AKT thing is, but still Capi was effective in this phase 3 trial. The thing I wanted to point out was this patient already had type 2 diabetes, was on metformin, was obese, had metabolic syndrome, hemoglobin A1C of 7.4, fasting blood sugar is 140 to 160. Here you see the BMI is 31. And so I was figuring when we presented this case, we had Dr. Vizazi, who actually was the principal investigator of this. I was figuring they say, oh, no way we're going to give the drug. And they were like, no, the patient's hemoglobin A1C was under 8, same bar that was in the breast study. They said, yeah, we would treat them. And incidentally, in the prostate situation, they were the other treatment the patients was getting was abiraterone and prednisone. So, and yet it doesn't look much different in terms of what they saw in terms of hyperglycemia. Any thoughts, Hope? We've shown video of you at GU meetings because they don't really know much about it.
Yeah, and I've been actually talking about this data and, you know, looking into the toxicity. And it's an interesting, you know, it's like old men with prostate cancer. They are a little bit different. They have more heart disease. They have indwelling Foley catheters, and so they get more urosepsis. So there actually were a few sort of different toxicities, which I think are probably not that related to CAPI, but related to what's going on with their disease itself on abiraterone. And apparently abiraterone itself is associated with some hyperglycemia and GI toxicities, and you are giving steroids along with it. So it's an interesting question about what happens in that group of patients. I think that the toxicity will be manageable, but people need to be aware of it. And it's, you know, I think exciting that they saw the efficacy data, but, you know, there will need to be some education, just like we've done in breast cancer, about how to manage this in these patients who are maybe higher risk for infection than our patients because of the indwelling catheter and have some other comorbidities that our patients don't have as much.
Right. I mean, the average age is 7 or 8 years older than breast cancer to start with. They're also on LHRH agonists, so they have metabolic syndrome from that, and yet they seem to tolerate it pretty well. I want to also get into the issue of metformin. This is something that Maria had pointed us toward, which is the American Diabetic Association. They have an incredible long paper detailing the approach to this. And one of the things they bring up in this, even though most of it's not about cancer, is the use of preemptive metformin. And Marie, maybe you can talk a little bit about this Metallica study. What they saw there was with alpelisib, but in terms of preemptive metformin, how you give it, and what are some of the toxicity issues or side effects to consider?
Yeah, sure. You know, the Metallica study was trying to get at this question of whether preemptive or co-administration of metformin would be useful. And this was pre, so not co-administration, before starting alpelisib, which is what we try to do now. You could see that they titrated relatively quickly. A lot of times we do 500 milligrams once a day for a week, and then we go to twice a day for a week. But we try to do a quicker ramp up here. But it's all to improve tolerance. So I think it was 7 days up to, and then to 1,000 twice a day, and then adding alpelisib. And what you can see, you could see a statistically significant difference, but it was pretty modest, I would say. So cohort A was the metformin group, and you could see they had one grade 3 to 4 out of 48 people. They had one episode grade 3 to 4, and then versus 3 in the other group, and it was statistically significant. But I was struck a little bit by the low prevalence overall of grade 3 to 4 in this very small study. I thought it was a little bit smaller, you know, lower numbers than I would expect from my experience, but. But it was helpful, and the thing about this, the Metallica, was that it showed feasibility, you know, that it works, that it's doable, and patients tolerated it.
I'm kind of curious. Do you think it's worth using in all people, or just those at higher risk, Marie?
It's a very low risk drug, metformin. I mean, it can increase diarrhea, and that's really the only major issue. And so there was talk about putting metformin in the water, quote unquote, a long time ago before we had GLP-1 receptor agonists. So it really is considered a safe drug. It's been used, you know, people have been on it for 30 years to prevent diabetes. So I think you could potentially co-administer metformin with a PI3 kinase inhibitor that is at a higher risk of hyperglycemia without any concern.
It's interesting, too. It has, an intra-bowel mechanism of action. So in a way, it's kind of not even like a systemic therapy.
Most of the effect is in the gut. I think that's true. It is interesting because it's an mTOR inhibitor. People know this in oncology. It has this backwards mTOR inhibition. It's not been a therapeutic that's been effective in breast cancer as far as how it's been studied thus far. But it is a, you know, it has anti-cancer, you know, features, you could argue, without the evidence, I know that, but we actually are a fan of metformin in cancer for that reason as well.
So we're going to maybe quickly finish out with another case here from Hope, but just come back to you, Giuseppe. What's your experience with metformin? Are you using it preemptively?
No. Usually I use only for patients with a borderline hyperglycemia at the baseline assessment. So I give to this patient a diet indication, hypocaloric diet, and of course I start metformin. Don't forget that in the breast cancer field, we did many trials with metformin also in the area of setting, because we believe that potentially may impact interfering with the metabolism also in the outcome. But when you have a clear diabetes, I prefer to discuss the case with the endocrinologist.
Jamie, any comments on your experience with metformin, particularly in terms of tolerability, any issues?
No, I agree with what's been said. I think it's pretty well tolerated, just a little bit of GI upset, but most of the time well tolerated, and you don't need to dose reduce or stop the drug.
All right, well, let's finish out with this 69-year-old lady, Hope. What happened with her?
Absolutely. And I will say, you know, if you really push that metformin dose up to 1,500 twice a day, people do get GI, at least
they do. They do if it's quick,
Nausea, diarrhea, et cetera. So you just got to be careful with that because we have alternate agents. So this is a patient who's 69, and she came from Mexico and first diagnosed in 2007. Then in 2021 had an axillary node recurrence off all endocrine therapy. So she got chemo again, kind of a weird course. She had a lot of toxicity from the treatment and had a mastectomy and axillary node dissection, got exemestane. But while she was on exemestane, she developed bone pain and axillary node involvement and was found to have extensive bone metastases. And actually, she was in Mexico somewhere in a rural place where they ran out of fulvestrant after they gave her two doses. They did give her abemaciclib for 5 days and she got toxicity and stopped right away. So her son brought her to the U.S. where she had insurance. And we started her workup all over again and found that she had extensive disease, including bone and liver, had a PIK3CA mutation, tumor mutational burden of 9.49, so borderline. We did a biopsy of a left breast mass, which had not been biopsied and was ER positive at 50%. And then she got radiation. She had a lot of pain to L3, 4, and C7 to T2. So then we started her on the Anava 120 regimen, and she hadn't gotten a lot of treatment in a while, right? So I gave her Palbo, Anavo, and continued fulvestrant. But, you know, her hemoglobin A1C when she started was 6.2, although her glucose was good at 107. But so we started her actually on metformin quite early at 500 milligrams twice a day, but it took her a while to fill it. So anyway, because of these insurance issues. So you can see her glucose started to go up. We started her on metformin, but we also dose reduced the Anavo to 6 milligrams, and her neutrophils were low and persistently low, so we resumed her Palbo at 100. So now we dose reduced both drugs. So then she started on a second hypoglycemic drug, as you can see, sitagliptin, I think. But anyway,
yeah, that's right.
Oh, good.
You got it.
We increased her metformin up to 1,000 milligrams twice a day. And the sitagliptin, you know, I had to talk to some endocrinologist about it because I couldn't get her in right away. But you can see her glucose really didn't come down much. And she just, you know, she kept having this higher glucose and higher hemoglobin A1C. But her disease was amazing. Like, we started the treatment. Within 2 weeks, her bone pain was gone. She was eating better. She looked great. So then she starts losing weight because she's hyperglycemic, and she gets admitted for pneumonia and hypoxia. So we held everything. You can see her glucose went way down when we held all of her drugs because she said to me through a translator, "So do I really have diabetes?" I'm like, "Well, you had pre-diabetes when you started." So anyway, we restarted again with one further dose reduction right before Christmas, Anavo and Palbo with additional dose reduction. And she's doing great. I just saw her actually this week. And she did really well. She's still doing extremely well. Her tumor markers remain normal. She has some pain from a separate issue, but she's actually, you know, doing great in terms of her response to treatment. But it was quite a lesson to me about managing the hyperglycemia in a patient who's, you know, probably a little bit low performance status and a little bit low on medical knowledge. So, so a little bit harder to manage in that way. And then trying to sort of figure out, maneuver the drug dosages and the complication of the pneumonia.
So, Marie, any closing comments? Any thoughts about this case?
Yes. Quick question for Hope. Is she still on the metformin now?
Yeah, she's on both drugs.
On both drugs. Okay. Yeah, sitagliptin is it's a low potency drug, but it has no side effects. So we will be tempted to use it, but it's not that effective in a lot of people. It sounds
right,
like
it
in
wasn't
Europe,
for her.
it's really kind of and it's a lot of money for a lot of people. So we tend to avoid it unless we think we only need a tiny smidge of a medicine. But that's a very, very good case. One important thing about the metformin, and I'll say it again, is definitely use extended release formulations. It's much more gentle on the belly. Yeah. But otherwise, that's a great case. And it sounds like reducing the dose was part of the strategy, along with continuing the therapy.
So Marie, Hope, Jamie, and Giuseppe, thank you so much. This has been a great experience. I wish we had another hour to talk about it. Maybe we can do it another time. But audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Marie. Hope, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jamie, Giuseppe, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
Bye.